the last programme, we heard about the various trials and tribulations Brian Wilson encountered during the recording of the ill-fated Smile album. One of his closest friends during this period was David Anderley.
I became associated with Brian because his music was just killing me. I loved it. And all of a sudden, there were like new elements in the Beach Boy life. A lot of the contacts I had made in the so-called underground here, I started bringing around to Brian. The press started paying attention, national press, underground press, all the people. He was getting phone calls from Paul McCartney and Andy Oldham. The mystique of Brian Wilson was growing. The tracks he had laid down, and this is when now I became really involved with the studio, because I'd go every night with Brian and just watch what was going on. He cut the entire album, incredible tracks. They came back from England and listened to most of the tracks and didn't like what was going on. And during the course of this time also, I helped Brian start Brother Records and did that for a while.
Two interesting points were raised by David Anderley there. The first about the group not liking what they heard of the Smile tracks tends to underline what Van Dyke Park said previously. The group themselves don't seem to remember it that way now, but maybe they were influenced at the time by the overwhelming reaction at their concerts to the older material. After all, it was they and not Brian who were doing the touring, and perhaps there was a reluctance to go too far too fast. Anyway, the other point that David Anderley raised about the setting up of Brother Records is a more tangible one. The group had decided to form their own record company to gain greater artistic freedom and closer economic control, reasons which are very familiar nowadays, but at the time were quite new. This even predated the Beatles' Apple label. Initially, Capital had consented and Smiley Smile appeared under the Brother Records banner. Unfortunately, it was in name only. Everything else was as before. And so by the next album, Wild Honey, they reverted to the official Capital trademark until they could make some more permanent and effective change. We've already heard the title track of Wild Honey, but of course the other single that came off that album and carried them into 1968 was this one, called Darlin'. Darlin', written by Brian Wilson with lyrics by Mike Love, and there's no doubt that Mike preferred a fairly direct and obvious approach to lyric writing rather than the sometimes obscure word imagery employed by Van Dyke Parks.
Once he posed the question to me, "Over and over the crow cries, uncover the cornfield. What does that mean?" I said, "Mike, I don't know." I had written the words, see, and I was seeking the threshold for... "Over and over the crow cries, uncover the cornfield. Jesus." So I said, "Mike, I don't know." Soon I was fired, I dissolved my relationship with the Beach Boys, and 7 years later they put out Surf's Up.
More like 5 years, actually, but in any case, the Beach Boys had become more self-reliant musically and more introspective as a group at the same time. Mike Love.
The turning point was that Smiley Smile. Going back then, that was a turning point philosophically. Instead of being all outward and expansive and big orchestrated tracks and everything, it went back to all introspective, very light, harmonious, personal kind of things. And then it moved on to Friends. And I was in India when Friends was being recorded. And I came back and did some things and contributed a couple of things. But it was just... we've been friends now for so many years. We've been together through the good times and the tears. Turned each other on to the best things that life has. Yeah. Well, it was just more of a personal kind of a thing and an introspective thing. So that time period was a turning point intellectually and emotionally and artistically, I think, for the group. It kind of cleared everything away, I think. Although we weren't selling out any, you know, Madison Square Gardens in, so... You know, from that point of view, we were in the background. But musically, we were just really developing. More individuals in the group began to write during that time. And whereas before, Brian was doing all the music. And now everybody can contribute musically. So I think it's a stronger group, actually.
Friends. And proving the point that Mike Love had just been making, that song was written collectively by Al Jardine, Brian, Dennis and Carl. Well, ever since the severance of the professional relationship with their father, Murray Wilson, the group had been without a personal manager. They did have various people working for them, however. Dick Duryea performed the function of tour manager for the group through their American production company, and Nick Grillo had become their business manager in late 1966 at the group's request, after having previously handled their account for them at the company in which he had worked. So, in the spring of 1968, Dick Duryea and Nick Grillo were about to set up a string of concert dates for the group. Nick Grillo.
At that time, we decided to promote our entire southern tour. It was in the spring, and we were preparing ourselves to play, I believe, 24 concerts in 22 cities. And the Beach Boys, of course, headlining the show, and the other acts consisted of Buffalo Springfield, Soul Survivors, Strawberry Alarm Clock. The first date of that tour was in Nashville, Tennessee. When the boys arrived in Nashville, Dr. Martin Luther King was pronounced dead in Memphis, Tennessee, almost at the time that the boys deplaned. And about a month before, we were contemplating putting together a tour with Maharishi for the month of May, which would sort of follow the April tour, and we thought that both tours would be very successful financially. So we were simultaneously working on both tours. When the April tour became a disaster, a total disaster, because a lot of the dates couldn't be played because of martial law, a lot of the cities were being burned, it was a financial disaster. And we then tried to regroup and start to buttress up the May tour with the Maharishi. That May tour was quite a fiasco. At the time, Maharishi was in Europe, and I believe he was contemplating on doing some sort of a film for 4-star television, or possibly 4-star films, and he had already committed through his U.S. representative to do the tour with the boys. And again, we had, I forgot how many cities mapped out, major halls, and the boys would be on the show, and then the second half would consist of Maharishi lecturing and having a question and answer forum. The tour was delayed by about 2 days because he then had signed some sort of an agreement to continue on with the filming with 4-star, and it got to the point where we had to almost threaten litigation in order to have him acknowledge his responsibility to us, which he committed to sometime in the early part of 1968. I feel that a lot of people felt that the boys were trying to capitalize on something that the Beatles made popular, which was not the case at all. I think that they were very serious about transcendental meditation. But at that time, I think Maharishi was receiving a great deal of criticism in the U.S. press. So the tour really did not develop as well as we had anticipated. The entire problem came to a head back east. We were playing at a university. I think it was in New York State somewhere. It was on a Sunday. And the 4-star people were at the concert, and we were trying to negotiate a way of having Maharishi continue on with our tour and at the same time fulfill his commitment to 4-star. And we decided that rather than embark on the balance of the tour and lose money and creating a great deal of ill will with Maharishi and the 4-star people, that we decided to abandon the balance of the tour. And we had to handle this very delicately, and I think it was a press conference was held, and we told the press that Maharishi became ill because of his trek through Europe prior to coming to this country with the filming with 4-star. He became very ill, and when he did arrive in this country, he was in fact, very ill, and wasn't getting any better, and so that he was convalescing somewhere in Santa Barbara. But in fact, he left the country.
TM from an album by Charles Lloyd called Waves, and featuring the voices of Mike Love, Carl Wilson, Hal Jardine, Billy Hinchey, who's Carl's brother-in-law, and Pamela Polland. Alan, Mike and Carl, to different degrees, have all retained their involvement in TM right to the present day. So not surprisingly, perhaps, Mike Love doesn't see the failure of the tour with the Maharishi in quite the same way as Nick Grillo.
We'd had this idea to go on to some of the major liberal arts universities, and we'd play some music and Maharishi would speak. And it wasn't thought of as a venue, a show or something, and yet we went away. We came back and found out that this promoter that was handling the tour had put it into all these city arenas and things like that. It just didn't feel right. It just wasn't the kind of a thing where you'd ask $4, $5, and $6.50, you know, or whatever it was. It was more or less of a departure from that. We had hoped and go to the major liberal arts colleges, of which there may be 10, 20,000 students, and play for a low ticket price and just kind of bring that awareness to them of what TM was really about. Mm-hmm. So from that point of view, I was disappointed that it was mishandled.
It was Dick Duryea who had to coordinate the tour for the Beach Boys and find a promoter for it.
We hired for this a man called Bud Filippo in New York City, a promoter who had quite a few contacts with DJs and things around the country. And we worked up quite a good tour. We had Philadelphia, the Spectrum, 18,000 seat arena, and you know, it was a big thing. The biggest fiasco of my life ever I've been involved with. The Maharishi was a nice man, but nobody wanted to listen to him. They came to see the Beach Boys, and we went on stage, started talking. They all left. So we played 3 dates, and we canceled the rest of them. But Mike dearly loves the man and his philosophy, and I don't put him down for it. I just remember the times that we held the aggravation and problems we went to, and they must have lost $250,000 on that tour.
The classic line of this whole thing was rendered by Al Jardine, and it was in Newsweek magazine. We were able to get a feature story in Newsweek magazine after the tour, and Alan Jardine's line was that the only people that would make money on this tour would be the florists in the various cities. And I mean, that summed up, I think, the whole Maharishi tour. I think it was, there was such profundity in that statement that I realize it more and more each day. It was just classic.
Perhaps the real definition of flower power. Fortunately, there was no lack of enthusiasm for the Beach Boys in Britain. And as far as their singles were concerned, they're all set to do it again. Another big success in Britain for the group, in fact reaching number one in the charts for just 1 week early in September. It was much needed encouragement too, because at this point they were still not doing too well in America.
There was a time in 1968, believe it or not, when the Beach Boys drew 200 people in New York City. Believe it or not. And then we went to England right after that and sold out a whole tour. I mean, it's so crazy.
Bruce Johnston. And for that tour in late November of 1968, it was once again Bruce who did much of the legwork for publicity purposes. Here's Roger Easterby.
He was very conscious about getting himself known because he was replacing Brian Wilson, who was God. And the funny thing about the Beach Boys is that he was always going to be with them. And yet not once on a tour did he ever come. It was always a last minute, oh, Brian hasn't come. But every time the British fans were promised that he would be with them. And he never was. And getting back to Bruce Johnston, he was the one that would always do anything. In fact, when they were in America between tours, he would ring me at 12 o'clock midnight with an idea. Mm. He was always pushing that group's image. And I think they owe a lot to Bruce that hasn't been said for the fact that he was very instrumental in always pushing them, and he would be the one that would always do the interviews. If the other members of the group say, oh, we'll do it tomorrow, Bruce would say, no, I'll come and do it now. Mm. And I think this was twofold. One reason, because he was new and he had to project Bruce Johnston being the new member, but also he realised how important it was to keep the group at the top at all times. And I think his influence came through in a lot of ways. I always remember, because I'd first been in contact with Bruce years before when I was at CBS, and he was a member of a duo called Bruce and Terry, and they'd made a record called Four Strong Winds. And Bruce always told me that if he ever went solo, he would do a record of Bluebirds Over the Mountain. And it's quite funny to see that the new single by the Beach Boys was Bluebirds Over the Mountain, which I think proved that he had a lot of influence later on in the group as well. But he very much was the leader off stage of the group. Although Mike Love, in fact, was the general on stage, and, you know, he controlled every movement, what they did and how. Off stage, it was very much Bruce Johnston who decided what they would do in the ways of promoting their image, and nothing was ever too much trouble for him.
Well, as Roger Easterby said, their new single released to coincide with the tour was Bluebirds Over the Mountain. And while the group were in England, their concert at the London Palladium was recorded, including the latest single. The live version of Bluebirds Over the Mountain. The B-side of the studio version was a song credited to Dennis called Never Learn Not to Love. Now, in many ways, Dennis is the most independent of all the Beach Boys, but this independence sometimes led to a certain amount of carelessness in his choice of friends, as their ex-publicist Derek Taylor recalls.
Dennis and his lame ducks. Dennis had always got a friend who was fantastic, who we had to take care of. Some of them stranger than known, weren't they?
Well, unfortunately, one lot did become very well known a little later. Nick Grillo remembers how Dennis met up with them.
He was traveling out near Malibu, I believe, one of the canyons, and he picked up a young lady that was hitchhiking, and I believe that she was hitchhiking with a friend of hers to the nearest gasoline station. And in inquiring as to who she was and where she was heading, she said that she was part of this caravan that was down from San Francisco, a bus, and consisted of about 11 or 12 gals and this one guy. And so he invited her, after the bus was repaired, to come visit him at his house that he was renting out in Pacific Palisades. And lo and behold, the bus did arrive there with the entourage, and the one male leader of this entire troop was Charlie Manson. And they stayed with Dennis for about, I believe it was close to 6 months. And during that period of time, Dennis was traveling with the boys on the road, and either Charlie himself or one of his clan members would come up to the office and pick up a check for food or an allowance check, because they were supposedly keeping an eye on the house while Dennis was away. They were driving Dennis's Ferrari, which always infuriated me. And we had all to do to maintain proper insurance coverage for Dennis because of his driving record, and he was letting, you know, some of these kids drive a $20,000 car. And so I wanted to know a little bit more about Manson, and I found out that he was down from San Francisco on probation, and he was involved in some sort of a holdup. He needed some employment down here, and so through the pressures placed upon us by Dennis, we sort of indicated that through his local probation officer that it would be fine for him to stay down here, because we were entertaining the thought of signing him on to Brother Records as a writer. And he would come up to the office and serenade the office staff from time to time, and we had to sometimes shout him out of the office because he would be interfering with the normal workflow of the day. I never went out to the house. I mean, other members of the group went out to the house because, you know, finding out one guy with 11 chicks, I mean, that's sort of a magic thing. And I wanted to find out what Charlie possessed. I believe at one point, Dennis was under a great deal of pressure from Charlie Manson. And I think that he was getting much heavier into a drug situation, which Dennis started to become concerned about and very frightened. And the use, I think, of hard drugs. It was no longer just marijuana. I think Charlie at the time was literally taking tremendous amounts of acid, and Dennis was getting concerned and wouldn't tolerate it, and asked Charlie to leave. And I know it was a very difficult time for Dennis because he was literally afraid of Charlie. I mean, what took place there for 5 or 6 months must have been a nightmare to Dennis, as he saw the personality of Charlie evolve, and he wasn't really that benevolent sort of a guy that he wanted everyone to think that he was. And I think what frightened Dennis more than anything else is just thinking about the fact that Dennis was sleeping under the same roof with him, could have just axed him up one night. Dennis literally said that. He was shuddered when he thought of what could have happened to him after the whole Manson incident.
That song, Never Learn Not to Love, is, as I said before, credited to Dennis Wilson. But once, when he was asked if it were true that Charles Manson actually wrote the lyrics, he said that it was, and that he paid Manson a considerable amount of money for them. As Dennis has the same facility as elder brother Brian for putting people on, it's difficult to know where the truth lies, and nowadays Dennis, perhaps not unnaturally, declines to talk about the whole Manson affair. What is certain is that Manson himself did record many of his own songs.
As a matter of fact, we recorded close to 100 hours of Charlie Manson's music up at the studio, Brian's studio. And I know that when that whole thing took place, we took the tape and put it in the vault. And, you know, no one realized the extent of what had taken place. And, you know, I had called up Time Life magazines in New York. And I thought that maybe some sort of a deal could be made with the tapes, you know, as a study on this guy's personality. I mean, not, you know, just to make money and release an album and have it on the charts. I mean, about really a medical type situation, because his music was, his lyrics were so so twisted and jaded.
In March 1969, the Beach Boys' last album for Capitol was released, simply called 2020. It was an important album because it provided further proof that much of the writing and producing pressure had now been shared by the group, along with Brian.
I think that was when we were all starting to become active. I think that's the thing about 2020, because I can see The Nearest Faraway Place, which Bruce did, and Cotton Fields, which is a song that Alan had wanted to do for quite a while. And Bluebirds Over the Mountain is a track that Bruce did on his own. I think he had a couple of guys play bass and drums, and it just started from that. And Dennis on Never Learn Not to Love. And Our Prayer, which was sort of an introduction to a prayer Brian had written, which was going to be for Smile. Cabinescence. It was easy.
The last track Carl Wilson mentioned there, Cabinescence, was one of the tracks that had originally been recorded for the Smile album, and now had been revised and re-recorded. Cabinescence, written by Brian Wilson and Van Dyke Parks. Well, yet another tour of Britain had been set up for the Beach Boys in late May and early June of 1969, and this time they were to do dates in Brighton, Hammersmith, Birmingham, Liverpool, Manchester and Glasgow. Well, that was the official itinerary, but in fact one extra date was played in Leeds. Jimmy Savile explains why.
Beach Boys. Incredible. Personally, I've always been a fan of theirs. Never really had a lot to do with them. We used to see them year on, year off sometimes at the NME Poll Winners concert, where they would pick up an award and I'd pick up an award, and we had a sort of working relationship that it was always good to see each other, but purely superficial. I went up to Bishop Auckland, which is a small place in County Durham, and I was going there to meet the workers that made these TV sets, and it was just an ordinary disc jockey job. And suddenly, one of the girls from the office of this firm came to me and said, "You're wanted on the phone. It's a call from Los Angeles." And so I thought they were joking, because even if I was in London, I wouldn't expect a call from Los Angeles. And I said, "Is somebody kidding to you?" She said, "No, it's the Beach Boys." And I said, "It's somebody having a joke." I then go to the phone, and lo and behold, with a sort of a crickly-crackly, there is Bruce at the other end talking to me. And when I pick myself up off the floor, I say, "Well, how on earth did you know I was in Bishop Auckland?" And he said, "Well, we got to know from Leeds Infirmary where you were." He said, "Listen, we're coming over to do a tour of Britain. Can we come and play for your nurses at the hospital on a free gig, you see?" And I said, "Well, of course you can." But it was all a bit too much to take, you see. And so he said, "Yes, okay then. When we come over, we'll sort the date out. We suggest the..." Whatever it was, and he made a date. I think it was a Sunday, I think it was. So, lo and behold, I put the phone down, and I think, well, this could never come to pass anyway, because, I mean, out of the blue light, that was ridiculous, you see. So I went back to the hospital, and I was then faced with a strange situation as follows. Should I say that the Beach Boys are coming over, because I've got to make some provision if they are coming, How can I keep it quiet? Because if I say the Beach Boys are going to hit Leeds where they weren't going to play anyway, there would be everybody and a dog crowding up to see them. What a position I'm in. Plus, if I made all the arrangements and the Beach Boys didn't turn up, I would then be pilloried and crucified and hung, drawn and quartered. So whichever way I looked at it, it was bad. But it was good, if you know what I mean. Anyway, I then crossed all my fingers and toes and went ahead with the arrangements that we took the nurses home over, and for this particular Sunday afternoon, the lads were playing in Liverpool, and I sent a coach to Liverpool to pick them up. And we didn't know what arrangement they'd make for power or amplifications or anything like that. And I was quite flatly refusing to believe that they were coming until, lo and behold, this coach rumbled into the ambulance park at Leeds Infirmary, and out stepped the Beach Boys. So they all come down to the boardroom, and we're having this lunch, and I can't believe it, and I'm thinking, oh, God bless us and save us, what are we going to do with sound? And I say, what have you brought with you? So they said, nothing. We've brought three acoustic guitars and a pair of drumsticks. What have you got here? I said, well, we've got about four operating theatres and 900 poorly people. So they said, oh, never mind. We'll have a go, you see. So we all teamed into the nurses' home, and about 150 incredibly delighted nurses and sisters and doctors and an astounded me, who thought it was all a dream, and the Breezy Beach Boys, they marched up onto the stage, and I said, well, here we are, the Beach Boys. And with three acoustic guitars, with the drummer sitting on a chair, playing on the top of a packing case, believe me, playing on the top of a packing case with a pair of drumsticks. And they had a tambourine, and he kept giving a little whack on the tambourine, and with one microphone between the three of them, or the four of them, or whatever it was, they gave us a session, the like of which I could never ever remember a live session in my life like it. In the first place, they sounded totally like the Beach Boys. In fact, they sang so good that they knocked themselves out. They sang for an hour and a quarter. They sang every song they knew, including Good Vibrations, because the nurses kept shouting. Nobody was sitting down. Forget it. I mean, everybody was standing up, and August sisters, who happened to be Beach Boys fans, were actually standing on chairs, two sisters on one chair, clutching hold of each other so they wouldn't fall off, bearing over the edge of everybody. And lads was up on the stage with their acoustic guitars, and they kept saying, Good Vibrations. So the Beach Boys said, Good Vibrations, certainly. Do, 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 do. And out comes Good Vibrations. Marvellous, just like they were doing it in the studio. In fact, they finished up their repertoire, and the only thing they had left was a thing without any instrumental accompaniment at all. It was like a barbershop quartet scene, and they sang two of those, and it finished. And I presented them with five operating gowns that we'd just had cleaned from a recent heart operation that I'd worked at, a triple valve heart operation. Actually, they were quite well into this surgical thing at the time, because they'd been to see a heart op in California, and it really turned them on. And I presented the lads with these gowns that had just come out of the laundry, and they thought these were great souvenirs. And I stood in that yard as the coach rambled out, and I said, I don't believe it. And I still don't believe it, but it happened to be true, because it was too fantastic for words.
On that particular tour of Britain, the group came over with Paul Revere and the Raiders, who were little known in this country and remain so even after the tour. On the face of it, it's a strange move to have made. Bruce Johnston.
Yeah, well, that was a mistake. We shouldn't have toured with the Raiders because it was a bubblegum kind of band. But we didn't have any direction. Unfortunately, when you don't have a manager, you don't have good perspective. You need a manager that is as good as you as an artist to give you some guidance. So we were making our own decisions, and a lot of them were really dumb. We wanted to see them happen in Europe because they were friends of ours, but it was the wrong combination. We should have taken Fairport Convention with us on the tour. I happen to be a big Sandy Denny freak.
Yeah, me too. As expressed by Bruce Johnston, the mistakes they made certainly seem symptomatic of the overall lack of direction that there was at the time. Just as they arrived in Britain, the news broke of a press conference that Brian had been given in Los Angeles, disclosing that the group were on the verge of bankruptcy. Nick Grillo, their former business manager, explains the position.
The boys, from an asset and liability point of view, had healthy financial statements. The problem that we did face was the cash flow. In other words, not having sufficient cash. We'd had excellent borrowing power, and we did borrow against some very important type investments to sustain us through some very difficult periods. We had to maintain a certain level of, I guess, an image because we had to maintain an office. I mean, their affairs are very complex, requires full-time employees, and at the same time accommodate all of our creditors that were literally breathing down our backs. And it took us, I would say, about 2.5 years to really get our heads above water, because for a period of 2 years, we were then involved in litigation with Capitol Records, and Capitol wasn't really, I feel, getting behind our product, and I don't think the boys themselves were really mentally prepared to really get into their own recordings, and the problems just magnified themselves, and for 2.5 years it was a nightmare.
Add Some Music to Your Day was from Sunflower, a beautiful album and the first record of the Beach Boys to be released by Warner Brothers in America, and which carried their Brother Records logo alongside that of Warner Reprise on the label. As I mentioned earlier, the Beach Boys themselves had reverted to the plain Capitol label after Smiley Smile, but they had managed to keep Brother Records itself going, although with some difficulty.
We had signed several acts to Brother Records. We brought in an outside black producer. We signed a couple of writers out of New York. And we had a staff. We had about 4 people at the time writing for us and cutting sides. And trying to really launch Brother Records as a label that would have different facets of music. And, of course, being headlined by the Beach Boys particularly. And as everybody just put pressure on the boys did not become interested in pursuing Brother Records. The enthusiasm wasn't there because they weren't getting the enthusiasm from people that should have been behind them and pushing. And I'm not talking about Capitol Records either.
Well, with the Capitol contract expiring in mid-1969, the group now had a chance to look around for a company that would take them on as Brother Records and give them the artistic freedom they so urgently needed. Nick Grillo again.
A great deal of interest was displayed by Deutsche Grammophon. And we negotiated a major deal with Deutsche Grammophon whereby, I believe it was a 14-album deal over a period of 3 years. And I believe 6 of the 14 albums consisted of Beach Boy product, and the other product would be new artists. We were in Berlin reviewing the deal with the boys, and at the time, Mike Love did not feel particularly satisfied with the deal. And I criticized Mike about it, and I could not understand why we had to wait until we returned to the States before we accepted the deal, because the deal could have been accepted right there in Berlin. But I feel in the long run that was the best move, that we did not fulfill that commitment with Deutsche Grammophon. And so we came back to the States, and we also were receiving a great deal of interest from Warner Brothers. Mo Austin had tremendous belief in the boys, Brian Wilson, and literally wanted them on the label. And realizing that they hadn't been selling that many records, and again, one of his classic comments was that he had a gut feeling that the boys will be a major force again in the music field, and he wanted them on his label. He definitely wanted them. And we negotiated a deal. It was Brother Records. The boys would be recording exclusively for Brother Records, but we could not really get Warners to shift from their position of just having the boys and not developing any other acts until things started to happen for the boys. Their careers came first in his mind, and he wanted to see them get back into the mainstream, and then we'd start developing other artists. And I think he was right. Yeah, he was definitely right.
Another track on the Sunflower album when it was released was the second song to emerge from the Smile period, Cool, Cool Water, Al Jardine.
I remember it took 48 hours to dub down Cool Water. Bruce and Carl and I were there for 2 sunrises, if you can believe that. That was interesting. But like Lewis and Clark, just, you know, discovering the Grand Canyon or something with the third day roll or second day roll around. It was done. I just felt like I'd arrived, you know. And then we rushed it over to Warner Brothers that day and got the typical A&R flip out from everybody, you know. Wow, great. And they were really impressed. They really liked Cool Water, and we thought it was really good. And again, it was one of those things, technically, I think, so really acceptable, but commercially so
subtle. It wasn't AM, let's put it that way. It's great FM stuff, though.